This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
We've seen a pattern over the last decade. Angry, isolated young men, mostly online, spiraling from rejection into rage, and then turning that rage outward. They call themselves incels, and while that used to sound like internet noise, the body count tells a very different story. We've seen it with Elliot Roger, Alec Minasan, Scott Borelli, and now Brian Koberger, who's pled guilty to killing four University of Idaho students in one of the most brutal cases that we've seen. Today, we're going to dig into the psychology behind it all. What pulls someone into the incel mindset? What is the incel mindset? What does it all mean, other than just kind of a weird word? You're going, well, that sounds creepy. And it should. And it's something more of us need to be aware of, especially if you have young teenage boys or you interact with them in any way, shape, or form, or your daughters or your children or anyone does. Because there's a lot of it out there. How does it escalate into violence, and is there any way to stop it before it gets that far? Joining me to discuss, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of the book, The Minds of Mass Killers. Get it wherever you get books. Siobhan, let's start at the beginning of the incel story. This started back a long time ago. It came from a support group started in the 90s, actually by a female. But obviously, it's since been hijacked by a lot of toxic misogynist subcultures. Let's start at how it originally began, though. Can you start there for us?
Yeah, as I understand it, it was fairly benign in the beginning, and a woman was involved trying to help these guys. But it quickly devolved into this echo chamber of rage and rather bizarre beliefs that women were intentionally trying to deny men sex, that there was like this conspiracy thinking. And it attracted a certain kind of young male. And the scary thing about these groups, because there are more than one place on, you know, online where people congregate about it, is that it reinforced these distorted beliefs. So you had angry, depressed, generally autistic young men with a lot of social problems, sexual frustration, and then they come up with this paranoid ideation that women are doing things to them intentionally without recognizing, hey, maybe I've got some social skill deficits here. Maybe there are some things about myself I want to work on. It didn't go that direction, which would have been the healthy direction. It took on this mythology of victimization. And over time, it increasingly became this force in the subculture that has resulted in murders.
And that's a shocking thing about this. When I look back at childhood or teenage years, and I think a lot of us do, I mean, we can all recognize that there was always some of those guys out there that were kind of, you know, off to the side, a little more quiet. They were awkward around women. I mean, there's always going to be guys like that. There always has been guys like that. A lot of times, you know, they get dismissed, they get bullied. And look, I'm not in any way sticking up for them. What I'm trying to say is we need to recognize this sort of stuff early on and not just brush it off as, well, they're quiet, they're the geeks, they'll be rich someday, they'll be the ones that get it together. A lot of times they're not. A lot of times they, and especially today, we have a culture that doesn't necessarily encourage moving on. It doesn't encourage finding your voice, finding your place in life. We have a culture of victimhood where people like to become victims. They like to be looked at as, oh, there's something that society is throwing at me and that's not fair, rather than let's rise above it. Why did all of that change? How did all of that change?
There seems to be this mix of what we would term clinically vulnerable narcissism, which is reinforced. And this is the narcissist who's profoundly focused on victimization. And this is a story that these impaired males adopt, because a lot of them adopt it when they're, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old. It starts very young. And I think it's the buying into that story rather than looking inward and coming up with ways that they can, you know, become healthier and have personal growth. And then the autism thing is really relevant because I think everyone that's gone on to become a mass killer in whatever form they did it has carried the diagnosis of fairly severe autism. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think we try to intervene early. But as you say, there have always been kids that are different. Some find their path out of it. Some don't. I happen to have had a son. I won't say which one. Mm-hmm. But he was socially awkward. He was nerdy. He was a geek. He played too many hours of video games. But we were able to direct his social awkwardness into things that he enjoyed. He wasn't really athletic, but he found cross-country running. We got him into karate, gave him a little bit more confidence. We got him in, well, we didn't get him. He was attracted to, but I certainly encouraged it, the chess club, and he became the chess champion of the school district and things like that. So kids need a way to become successful rather than this perverse sense of I'm a victim here that they find in these incel groups.
How much of that just kind of comes down to parenting? And I'm not trying to blame Koberger's parents. I feel like this is an area where, look, there's just not a lot of education that we got on this, you know, as parents coming up. There's not a lot of education our kids are getting on this yet as they're growing up. But when it comes down to parenting, you have some that kind of got it, like you did, you know, and many others do, where it's like, hey, you know, yeah, they're a different brain. But do too many parents go down the road nowadays of, well, that makes him happy, that makes him feel good, versus what's actually good for them? Where as a parent, you got to go in the category of what's good for them, not just what makes them feel good. That's why being a parent is being a parent and not just letting them run their lives and hope for the best.
100%.
They need some direction there because, everybody naturally is going to go to what feels good, and then you end up dead because you go down some sort of dark road of things that feel good and lead to chaos. There seems to be a lot of that, and there seems to be a lot of, I don't know if it's, is it learned helplessness? In the part of parenting? Is it learned helplessness on the part of the incels themselves? Why does it feel like we just hit a brick road with so many parents and so many of these folks where it's like, well, there's just nothing else I can do about it. They're just weird. They're just this, they're just that. It seems to be that a lot of folks have abandoned their realization that they have autonomy, that they have the ability to make their own choices, that they have agency. That seems to be a big missing piece and why we keep ending up creating folks like this.
You know, the big variable that I see literally with all of these folks is the internet. Mm-hmm. And parents, I struggled with that with my kids. Fortunately, when my kids were growing up, they still had, you know, dial-up internet where it took the phone out of commission for the family. So we had to set some limits on it. But the internet now, everything is so accessible. And I think parents see their kids unhappy. And then they get into, of course, it's online gaming. And that's a huge issue. And certainly with some of these mass killers, if not all of them, hours and hours and hours spent just online in their rooms isolated, and they go into very dark places. And I'll just add the thing about gaming, it's not that there's this directional linear link between gaming and becoming violent or becoming a mass killer. If so, we'd have a lot more of them if that were how it worked. But the problem with excessive gaming and time online is that it displaces other healthy activities. but they love it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to make them so happy. And so I think parents rationalize, well, they're not out partying. They're not out doing drugs. They're not out getting into trouble. So they're in their bedroom for 8 hours a day with the door closed and half the night. You know, it's benign. And the parents don't have a clue what their kids are up to online. And that goes across the board for all kids today with smartphones, and the girls are getting into groups about anorexia, applauding anorexia, mm-hmm. and the dangerous relationships with older men who are predatory yeah. toward kids. And that's one of the biggest concerns I have for people trying to raise kids in this really difficult to monitor environment is, you know, they're just letting them spend way too much time online.
It feels like online has become, you can find community now for bad decision making. You can find community now for disorders that one would otherwise in a healthy world want to fight, want to, you know, become the best version of yourself. So that's not pulling you down. Now it's more like a calling card. Now it's a trophy. Now it's something that folks sometimes are proud of in a weird way, rather than looking at it as, I'm not going to be happy if this is my identity. But they seem to find some sort of false happiness in other people who are just as unhappy, which obviously that's not going to create a happy outcome. It's just going to create a lot of cathartic energy that's very, very negative. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard thing. Like as a parent myself today, with a young daughter who's almost a teenager. Yeah, I mean, as much as I try to, you know, police what's online, it's nearly impossible. It is so damn difficult. I do spot check things every now and then. And, you know, luckily in my world with my daughter here, I haven't had any issues. I have a stepdaughter who's older now. When she was a bit younger, we had some issues of what we were finding, what she was getting into. But every kid is different. Just because you assume one didn't go down a path, you can't assume the other is going to do the same thing. And I think the big thing is, to parents, your kids aren't necessarily looking out how to become an incel or go into the, you know, pro bulimia group. It kind of finds them in a lot of ways through these other pieces of community. How, I mean, as you see this, you know, you have adult children, as you're looking back now and you're helping people and you're giving them advice, trying to navigate this world today, what do you tell parents that may be concerned about their children and this world that they're interacting with every day?
Yeah, I think making sure that they have as many activities going on in the real world as possible. And a lot of times people can get their kids really involved in athletics. That's not for every kid, yeah. and it doesn't mean it should be forced. But whether it's music, whether it's band, whether it's, you know, scouting type activities where they go out camping and learn wilderness skills. I mean, there's got to be this push for let's find what excites them, what gives them pleasure, and let's make sure that hours of their week are going toward those things rather than, you know, isolating in their rooms. The other thing is, you know, get involved in what they're doing online. I mean, I, at one point with my kids, when they were really into, I can't remember the game it was, mm-hmm. EverQuest. They were into EverQuest, mm-hmm. right? Late 90s. I started playing with them, mm-hmm. which was very weird at the time. Sure. Because, you know, here's an adult playing this game with their kids. Yeah. But I think it was a bonding activity for them. Between us, and it gave me a better sense of what that interest was, and we could all talk about it. So whatever your kids are doing online, if I mean, use spyware if you need to. If you've got a kid you're really worried about, if yeah. you know, you've got a daughter that's maybe being chased by a 35-year-old man on Instagram, it's like you've got to find a way to do some monitoring. It's just a safety concern.
It is. I mean, and it's one thing to kind of monitor and police it. It's another thing to educate them. And I think that's another thing that sometimes parents are afraid to do with their parents or with their kids. And I'm not saying, look, there's obviously, it's a whole thing over here on one side. If you have the kid that you think may be, you know, going into these unhealthy areas, it's another thing just to educate the ones who are not going into those areas to look out for the people that are coming from those places. Right. And I think a lot of people don't want to do it because it's icky. I don't want them to see the world like that. I don't like, well, sorry, that's what the world is. And if you'd like them to not accidentally fall into some of these dark holes and then deal with the repercussions and the trauma later, it's not a bad idea to teach them at a younger age that this stuff exists, as icky as it is. I've had my girls know Chris Hansen's name very well. If they saw him on walking into a room, that's Chris Hansen from To Catch a Predator. They'd recognize it because they watch it. They kind of laugh at these things, but they know how real it is. Mm-hmm. And them understanding how real it is and how these people are out there on a regular basis, the less susceptible they're going to be to fall into those holes. Do we need more of that? Just more exposure and less of the, well, they're just so innocent and they're just, yeah, they are. That's the problem.
And I think it's going to be happening. And I guarantee you, kids all have secret conversations with other kids that parents know nothing about. So, I mean, I've seen cases where 8-year-old boys were Googling rape videos online. I mean, you know, just things that they'd heard about and they were curious. And it's much better, as you're describing, for parents to have discussions about these difficult, dark topics, because I guarantee you they're talking with other kids about it or they're exposed to it online and they're not telling you. So,
I mean, when you're a young boy, I mean, unless you're like one of those few that are like super popular right out of the gate, and you know, there's this handful, you know, but if you're not, you know, it can be a lonely childhood. I was a dork. I had girlfriends here and there, so I wasn't like completely isolated. But when you're young and you're feeling rejected, it's very confusing. And especially as those hormones are raging left and right, you get angry about stuff that, you know, as an adult, you wouldn't. So it's very easy to fall into those paths. How much of it, too, is parents, when they're looking at this, you know, and looking at their kids, how much does narcissistic parenting play a role in this new evolution of children that we have, where if the kids aren't interested in something I'm interested in, well, I'm just going to let the computer, you know, they can go do their thing. They can find what they're interested in. That's fine. But I'm not going to be a part of it. Like you said, you took some interest. But if you're kind of a narcissist, yeah, a lot of people don't necessarily show interest in things that's not in their wheelhouse. And I think you have a lot of parents that do the same. If you're not, if you have parents that are big into sports and they loved high school and you're kind of the kid that doesn't like any of it, I was one of those. It feels really lonely because it feels like that support system that's supposed to be right there for you, well, I don't fit in with them either. And, you know, back then you didn't have support groups, you know, I said it in air quotes, support groups that reaffirm your anger. You had to go kind of figure it out on your own. Is that a big factor in this? Is just the parenting angle of show your kids some attention, whether you're interested in their stuff or not.
Yeah.
Pretend like you are. Fake it till you make it. You don't have, I mean, I could give a crap about baseball or sports, but you know what? If I have a kid that's out there playing it, I'm going to be there and I'm going to be watching it. Because it's the kid. It's not about me. It's about them. And in those formative years, it's not about you as mom or dad and how you're feeling. Deal with it. You're the parent now. You need to get out there. And you need to be in front of this with your kids and know what the hell is going on. It's a level of absentee parenting, but they're physically there, but they're not mentally.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the thing that kids really need, they need mirroring. That means, you know, being able to reflect back what you see in them in so many ways. You recognize their presence, you recognize their emotional state, you recognize their interests, their weaknesses, the places that they're struggling, the places that they're shining. I talked with a mom recently who was somewhat narcissistic, and she was really disappointed that her kid wasn't interested in sports because she's so into sports and she's a big tennis player and, you know, all about her interests. And she wanted her kids to share that. And she has a kid that doesn't, and he's into music, and he's won a scholarship to a good school based upon his musical ability. And she's kind of disappointed in that.
Yeah.
And so we had to do some reality checking on your kid is not you. And you have to enjoy and appreciate the qualities that make your kid unique. So, yeah,
that seems to
narcissistic parents.
I'm going to say that seems to be a common, I guess I would say, complaint that you'd hear amongst young people who are feeling isolated, who are feeling alone out there, is a situation very much like that. I don't relate to my family. I'm not like them. But you have that family member who views the kid and narcissist do and more of as an extension of themselves than actually an individual. And then that creates a lot of trouble defining their own identity or figuring out who they are as people, because they're not getting that mirroring back, or they're just not even getting the least amount of encouragement. They're just, oh, yeah, you're the black sheep, or whether it's said directly or not, they know it. And they know it's a chore sometimes for the parents to show some interest or spend some time. That seems to be a big thing. And the kids walk away going, well, you know, my family's not... That's if they're not getting it at school, if they're not getting, they don't have a good friend group, they could at least get it at home. And I feel like that's a place that is being they're lacking it so much, even with well-intentioned parents. I don't know why, but it feels like there's something missing in a lot of parents, the parenting gene, if you will, that knows how to get there and be in front of this with their kids. But again, you look back a few generations, we had a society where, you know, kids, you know, be seen, not heard. And that's sort of an outlook that's not that far back. Is it just now that we are starting to learn how to be psychologically and mentally present in a healthy way for our children? And this is why this is all such seemingly new territory for parents in general?
I think we're doing a lot better with it. Now, does that trickle down to everybody? You know, because you have to be interested in, I want to be the best parent I can be, and in a healthy way. And that doesn't mean molding my child to be in my own image, which is what you're talking about. But we sure have more, certainly, accessible information on how to attune to your kids and how to mirror your kids and what that looks like and how to recognize that your kid is going to have a different path. I write on those subjects all the time and speak about it and as you do. And I think that the information is there for people who want to learn how to support their kids.
And that's the biggest thing, people who want it, not just, oh, I'll do that, I'll get around to it. Suddenly they're 18 or suddenly they're 15 and shot somebody up and they're in jail. It's not a let's get around to it sometime. Your clock is ticking as they're young. Walk me through what happens here psychologically, for example, like when a young man logs into one of these forums, you know, and finds a community sitting there validating their most dangerous thoughts, their you know, angers, their frustrations with, you know, life, you know, with the world, that you're, women are not just going to bow down to you and think you're just the best thing on earth because you think you're a nice guy. What happens in these forums? And I mean, how you think of radicalization and stuff, forever we talked about that with like Middle Eastern countries and radicalization of terrorism. But I mean, this is another version of it. How does it go from, you know, I feel awkward around girls to I hate women and they should all die?
A lot of complaining, a lot of storytelling. They reinforce each other. They go into rage. They get that, you know, rage addiction. It's like it makes them feel better to be angry. And so it builds. And people who may have just come in with a sense of curiosity, it's like they catch that emotional tone and it changes their perceptions. And then they start with these revenge fantasies. And one of the images that we're looking at today is Elliot Elliot Rodgers, mm-hmm. and they create heroes and share stories about how many people were killed. And they even, you know, start to look at it as a game. Could I engage in something like this and get a higher kill score than he did? Which is really scary that we're gamifying murder. But it can get really extreme. And of course, the majority of them don't ever act out on it in any way other than they become really miserable people. Mm-hmm. But there are these few that have committed these atrocious crimes. And then they model after each other. I do think I have fairly well settled, I bet money on it, that the Papa Rodgers character that showed up on social media during mm-hmm. the initial phases of the investigation into the Idaho killings, I do think that was Koberger because we know he was fascinated with Bundy. It would make sense that Rodgers was on his radar. And I, you know, we were speculating before. I'm fairly convinced of it now.
How could it not be at this? I mean, the character, and I don't have it readily available, but if you just look it up, Papa Rodgers, online and Brian Koberger, the profile looked exactly like Brian Koberger. I mean, and this is before anyone knew who Brian Koberger even was. I don't see in any way, shape or form how it could be anyone else other than Brian Koberger at this point. The resemblance is stunning. And the information this person had, unless he told somebody else about this, some other incel that was messing with people, it had to have been him or someone who knew it was him. It's one of those two. I can't see it being any other way. There's all sorts of terminology and stuff that gets thrown around as there is in any sort of group. Black pill is one with the incels. The black pill ideology basically tells them that they are doomed by genetics and society. It's not a take the black pill and this will get better. It's take the black pill and forever live in sorrow and agony and never find a solution to your problems. That's an interesting way. I mean, is this new in society in terms of large groups of people just digging into something that literally has no solution and just wallowing in their pain and their sorrow and never trying to find a way out? It seems in almost any group historically, its goal is to get better, is to find a solution. This is, let's die in our sorrow.
Yeah, it's horrendously toxic, and I do think it's new. I certainly can't think of anything in history that was like that. You may have found a couple of people who found each other and reinforced that dark view, but to have this be a subculture, a fairly popular subculture that builds and amplifies over time. Yeah, I think this is another special gift from the internet here.
All the special gifts that we get from the internet, they just keep coming. And yes, I want to go back to like 93 for a day or life and be good when the internet was just very, very small. You said earlier, you know, very few act out on it. And I know when we're referring to that, or you were referring to that, we're talking about like killing, like getting out there, murdering people. Yes, that is a smaller number. But, and I don't know that we have the number to that, but I would argue there is a massive number that is getting out there and acting out on it, not necessarily to the murderous level, but to the let's be an extremely dysfunctional human being. Let's ruin lives. Let's ruin relationships. And sometimes don't even realize they're doing it because they see no reason to try and improve themselves. They just get themselves out there and interact in people's lives. And people are none the wiser until these people have caused so much chaos in the world. I would guess there's a lot of them out there that are simply doing that. And the damage factor from that group has got to be insanely higher than the murderous group. But the damage, the trauma, the psychological, all that stuff that comes along with it, that's got to be a huge number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the misogyny.
Yes.
I think we've still got terrible problems with people who treat women abusively. Mm-hmm. And even though these guys may or may not ever find a real woman to be involved with, my guess is when they move through the world, these are not nice people to women.
Yeah.
And and it leaks out.
And it feels like it's a different type of misogyny than we've had in the past. I mean, in the past, it's felt... I don't know. I'm not trying to, and I'm not, you know, endorsing it, but it seemed it was based more on what you would call like traditional values of, okay, the wife is at home, the man works, and that sort of misogyny where it's class, it's roles, it's things of that. This is hate. You know, in misogyny in the past, you know, if you had a man that was working and the wife was the homemaker, I mean, in a healthy relationship, typically the man came home and he didn't hate the wife. There's plenty where there was, you know, beating and all that. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about a society that was very different in the way they looked at things, but it wasn't, we're in these roles because I think you should die because you have breasts and a vagina. Today there's that, and that's what makes it a very different type of misogyny. Would you agree?
Yes, yes. Yeah, and I think it leaks out the kind of porn that's being produced now that these guys consume. I always say I think I've seen everything, and then I'll see something else that completely shocks me. You know, the idea now that we have porn not only centered on rape, but centered on, you know, dismembering people with those kind of fantasies, snuff kinds of porn out there.
There's dismember porn.
Well, and they don't actually do it, but it's the fantasy. Oh, and yeah.
Yeah, that's not breeding serial killers or anything.
Yeah, yeah. And the choking, you know, this is coming up in younger people, women who come to therapy. Well, the new guy she was dating was into trying to choke her and coming to therapy about it because is this normal and I'm not okay with it. And it's like, this is stuff that I didn't used to hear about. Yeah. And so it's again, this anger, this rage, this desire to hurt or kill or maim women, it's really alarming.
Is another problem that we have in our country the fact that sex is so faux pas and that we don't talk about it much, yet it's infiltrated in everything that we have. We have access to anything anyone wants to watch in any way, shape, or form. And now with AI, you can just make it up, and then it shows up for you. And we don't discuss it. So it just, it gets out there. It invades a young person's mind in a very different way than it ever used to. It used to be young people, oh, you found your dad's Playboy or something. Mm-hmm. Now it's like, let's watch a gangbang, I guess, involving, you know, dismemberment or whatever the fuck people are coming up with.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, then people don't talk about it. It just festers. It lives in someone's mind. And then people find, oh, I'm into this weird shit. But they don't talk about it either. Is that an issue? Is that a uniquely American problem where other countries... You go to the UK, there'll be full-blown nudity and sexual, you know, conversations are much easier to have with that culture versus the US culture, where things are more sexualized, but we don't talk about it at all. If there was a healthier conversation going on, I'm wondering if that would help.
I think we have to acknowledge reality that this stuff is out there, that kids are accessing it. And how do we model for kids that sex, I'm a bit conservative, right? Mm-hmm. Put it off to my age or whatever. But I think sex should be about human connection, right?
Sure.
And that's when it's healthy and positive and people aren't being hurt because it's based upon empathy and compassion for the other person. And I would like to see people having those conversations about, you know, sex should be about personal growth and love and safety and everybody's making each other feel good. And it's a pleasant, positive thing when you're developmentally ready for it. And how to model that for kids and show kids that in our relationships. Another thing that I've heard repeatedly is dad is home alone with the kids or up late at night by himself. And dad is on weird porn sites. Mm. And the kids walk in the room and see this. And then they go and tell mom. And then there's uproar in the home about you know, again, it gets back to what are parents thinking? It's yeah. They're not a lot of times.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, or they're not thinking.
Yeah.
And the big thing, I think one of the things that seems to allow this to fester, obviously it's reinforcement from community and such, but it's also a view that I would say that I've seen in some men. They're more like boys that I've worked with, that I've met over the years. I can think of a guy I worked with a long time ago who I would totally say was an incel. They view themselves as a nice guy. And on the surface, if you weren't to get into their rage, if you weren't to trigger that rage and hear their hate of women or their rejection, they really do appear to be like, oh, okay. I mean, at least some of them do. Like, oh, they're going to help you and all that. But then you start getting on the conversation of, oh, you know, you got a girlfriend or whatever. And it's like, whoa, that's the topic that rage comes out in. But they still walk away thinking they're this nice guy. Why wouldn't women like them? It's like, well, because you tense up, and the second the woman looks at you a weird way and you think that you deserve better or whatever the hell's going through them, that nice guy complex seems to be a big thing with them, does it not?
It does. And I go back to Elliot Rodgers again, who called himself the supreme gentleman.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you were a psychopathic, narcissistic, sadistic murderer who fantasized about killing all the women on the planet, but still called himself a nice guy. And you talk about a misperception of reality. It's almost delusional. But yes, you do find people who maybe have this kind of submissive quality in relationships until, as you say, you hit that trigger issue for them. And then you see the rage.
And that's a big question. I mean, what makes someone, decide to, you know, go from living this, you know, semi-normal life to thinking, yeah, I'm going to try and outdo Elliot Rodger there's no path in this equation where it's going to work out well for you. Yeah. You're not going to eliminate women and the problem's going to be done. You're not going to teach any lesson and people are going to be, you know, respecting you. It just looks more and more crazy, but they don't seem to see that aspect. And that's why we have the problem we do, I guess.
Yeah. The word that came into my head as you were describing that is it's kind of semi-delusional, mm-hmm. if not fully delusional. And so this is a person, again, that may pretend and appear to be normal, but their thought life is not normal. And it's probably something that progresses gradually over time, depending on their life experiences and the things that they're exposed to. Is their perceiving is really not in reality.
The thing with this, and I want to talk about this too from a parental standpoint or just someone who's seeing this or noticing this, because we talk about look for the red flags. I think a lot of us can identify the red flags. I think a lot of us have identified the red flags in a lot of cases, in a lot of people. We see them. The fact is there's just nothing you can do about it until they actually do something. I mean, if you're seeing your kid on these sort of forums, short of taking away their computer and isolating them from the internet, that's not going to stop anything. They'll find other ways of getting there. This is a shift, a psychological shift that would have to be made in someone if they've already gone down that road. And I'm guessing that's not an easy shift to make. Right. I mean, especially for someone who maybe has been there for a long time. Let's talk about that for a little bit. If you're a parent and you got the 15-year-old that seems to think, you know, Elliot Rodger, you know, is a hero, or just somewhere along that path that they have this anger towards women. They're isolated. They're doing their own thing, but they seem to have some warning signs here. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do?
Horrifying. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
And I would say, of course, I'm going to say, since I'm a therapist, get that kid into therapy.
Yeah.
But sometimes the kid is not at all cooperative with that idea. And mm-hmm. there are all kinds of ways of I'll say manipulating, of manipulating them into therapy. But probably the most helpful thing for a parent is the parent get to a therapist and figure out in our unique family, in our situation, what are strategies for intervening with my kid here? So you're not just there to talk about yourself, although you can do that, talk about your stress and frustration, but talk about how do I manage this and how do I intervene? And, you know, a lot of times some of the things that are helpful are getting a mentor. You know, maybe you can find, and this is something a therapist could probably help guide you. How do you find that if you're a single mom and your kid doesn't have a good dad figure in life and is involved in this dark stuff online, how can you find a big brother person, somebody who's in their 20s or 30s that can really be a mentor and get this kid out of this dark place and involved in healthier activities?
I agree. Much easier said than done. And especially if you have a kid that's in that mindset and you suddenly are like, hey, you're going to go hang out with this person. And they're going to be like, screw you. I mean, that's the reaction you're going to get. And that's the scary part of, like, once you go down this road, is there coming out of this road? I mean, it's a lot of steering, but I mean, this is an ideology. And once you kind of been radicalized to a certain extent of believing you're in the right and they're in the wrong, I don't know how you really pull yourself out of this one. I mean, is there data showing that it happens, that it works maybe very early on? Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know of any data. It would be a hard one to research. I do think that there's hope. At the end of the Mass Killers book, I talk about a case that was referred to me because somebody was making threats to shoot up their school. Mm-hmm. And it's really, and he did not want to be in therapy, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was the place we started, was it really sucks when your parents and the school forces you to come talk to me. And I totally validate that, because who am I, you know, and what do I know about your life? And so you validate that they don't want to do it first off. And sometimes then that causes a click and all of a sudden, hey, you're okay. I want to talk to you. But I think the biggest hope is heart-to-heart connections with somebody. And if you can't do that with your parent, you've got to find somebody else that's a healthy person, healthier, certainly.
That's the key.
And really develop the ability to have a bond with them. Some of the other cases where somebody has been in a very dark path with white supremacy and got into a university where they were around people of other races and connected on a deeper level than maybe they had up in their home in Idaho, right, where they were from.
Idaho, go figure.
Some of those people have written books about how that happened for them. And once they had heart-to-heart, deeper connections with healthier people who were different from them, reality started to shift for them. So I like to hold hope that there are paths out of it. But it sure can be a scary time for parents if they discover this kind of stuff.
It's got to be. And it's one of those things where, like, I think if you're discovering they're already really into it, is it too late? Where, you know, try and make a connection there. But the best damn thing is, if you have a kid, keep that connection going as best as you can from a very young age. Don't wait until, they turn 12 and now they're kind of off doing their thing. And at 15, I really have to intervene, but you missed the last 3 years of their life because you're just letting them explore. Like, yes, let them explore, but be part of their life. And at the very least, even if it's not that, you know, best buddy connection you had when they were eight, try and keep something. Try and keep some window of communication open, I would think, because I think all this goes to chaos is when there is no more communication. I mean, is that one of the keys, you would say, as to how this can go really off the rails, is when parents just have given up and it's like, you go figure it out and good luck in life?
Yeah, it's when the kid is negative and moody and starting puberty, and they're sort of relieved when, look, he's in his room and he's playing these harmless video games all night and staying up too late and playing all weekend long. But they're not in my hair then, and I'm not dealing with the moodiness. And so they disconnect and they allow that disconnection to happen. And you can't let that go on for 2 or 3 years and then expect that you're going to just magically come in at some point when there's been some red flags and say, and now we're going to do this all different. You have to maintain that mirroring throughout life. It's a hard job. And you've got parents who are both working long hours and struggling. And I see so many parents who are just losing their mind from stress. And so it's a big problem in society. We don't have, you know, in most families, you don't have a parent who's at home all the time. Kids spend far too many hours alone. I know even I was a working parent when my kids were teenagers, and I knew they were spending too much time online. And I would my way of coping with it, which was very naive, was to unplug the keyboard and take it with me in the back of my car, you know, to work. And soon I discovered that the kid just went down the street and borrowed somebody else's keyboard, you know. So I'm like, oh, well, that didn't work. So I don't want parents to feel shame over the struggle, because I know it is a struggle. But it's just critically important that we do our best. And if parents are just feeling absolutely overwhelmed, find a therapist for themselves to help with coping strategies and ways to attune to their kids. And sometimes some family therapy is helpful.
Because you're not going to be a good parent if you're not in a good headspace yourself. And
100%.
And that is so important in all of this. Because I get it. I mean, I'm exhausted by the time I walk out of the studio at night. But I make sure that I'm spending a couple hours with my daughter every single day, whether she's in a pissy mood or not. And it's just, I'm there. And, you know, sometimes I'll just, even if she's in a pissy mood, I'll just hang out, be in the same room with her. And usually after a little while, she comes over, starts talking. And you'd be amazed what a little patience would do. Parenting is not an easy job. And I think a lot of folks really, you know, they know that. But it doesn't have to be as difficult as we make it if we just put the effort into it. You know, it's like a recipe. If you don't look at the recipe and it's something you've never made and you take a guess at it, but the recipe is right there, probably not going to turn out right. If you spent the extra 5 seconds to read the recipe and use the ingredients that you have, it will probably turn out right. But you just have to take that extra bit when you already feel too tired to do it, because that's going to be the most important job of your life. And I feel like a lot of folks, it's just like, oh, it's too much.
And the other thing you do, which I admire so much, is you go on trips with your daughter.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have adventures with your daughter. You include your daughter in things. And so many people are doing the opposite. They want to get away from the kids. And so they leave the kids somewhere else while they go on the trips. And it's again, it's just putting the time in.
It is. I mean, if you have a mindset of I want to be away from my family and the people that I'm supposed to love, your kids are going to do the same thing. And then you're going to lose them. And then you're going to, you know, hopefully, I mean, if you do lose them, hopefully they find a path that isn't insane or full of, you know, horrible consequences. Some do. Otherwise, you know, they could use a hand from a parent if it's a healthy human being, but you got to be there first. Let's talk for a moment about Brian Koberger. I mean, his background, social rejection, misogynistic comments, obsessive behavior. And, you know, it's up in the air. A lot of people don't necessarily get diagnosed with being an incel. But from what we know about Koberger, and we don't know if he was on any forums or not, is Koberger an incel? Is he someone we could look at and go, this seems to be the motivation for your ideology here?
I would bet money on that. It sure fits. And when you put all the pieces of what we know about his history together, my guess would be that his online activity was very dark, and that this probably developed in early adolescence. And you combine that with an autism diagnosis, with obsessive compulsive disorder, all these other qualities. It's part of a puzzle that I think has come together.
I mean, it really is. And again, when you see folks like this, I mean, it's not, I would say it's not super difficult to pick them out from a crowd, at least if you're talking to people a little bit. Is that our biggest problem? We can see something, we can say something. It's just we're very limited in what we can do about something. And in reality, if let's say it's not your parent, you know, or it's not your child, you're not the parent, where you do have a little more option for how to help that person. If it's someone you work with, someone that, you know, is a friend or a friend of a friend, it's in that circle of folks, and you're seeing this sort of behavior. Obviously, it's not your job to go fix somebody, but, you know, what do you do? Is there anything one can do from that sort of a perspective if they're seeing somebody that's really getting off the rails in this, other than, you know, I'm going to back away because this person might be a loose cannon?
Yeah, it's hard to recognize so often that we are powerless over these kind of things. But I think it goes back to just making those human connections. And you never know, somebody that you took a little bit of extra time to befriend or invite to an activity, that may have been enough of a human connection to alter something inside of them that could have gone down a darker, more violent path. And I think we all have an influence in the world. We don't always know what that influence is, but that's one of the things I share a lot about social media, is those little tiny acts of kindness and compassion and seeing the people around us. And, you know, we can be a force of good in the world, and we'll never know what all the outcomes are.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like ultimately, at the end of the day, incels, or this way of thinking, is really a rejection of society as a whole. It's a rejection of humanity. It's a rejection of saying, humanity, life has not been good to me, so I'm going to screw it over in the same way I've been felt screwed over my whole life, and I'm going to go out with it. And ultimately that's a connection thing. That's a lack of connection thing. As much as they think they're getting connection online with their community, or basically murder simulators that they're playing all day. And they were like, why do they want to kill people? Why aren't you more into sports? Well, they're playing murder simulators all day. that's what they're into. And I'm not here to blame video games, but, you know, the world's a little different than was Mortal Kombat that I was being attacked on as a child. And because that was fairly fantasy and fantastical. Now they're playing games and stuff that are pretty real world, that basically show exactly what a lot of these people do. Look, that's got to play a role in it. I never thought I'd be the person arguing about video game violence. But, you know, it ain't the same as it was in the 90s.
No, some of it's absolutely horrific. There's one game, I won't give the name of it because I don't want to promote it, but it's a game about rape. And it's incredibly disturbing. And another book I wrote in the past was about video game addiction. And so I talked about that game a bit. And the degree of sadistic violence in games now, super disturbing, super disturbing.
It is. I don't play many. I have an arcade in my right outside of the studio of like 90s games. I don't play current games very much. My daughter does, but they're not, you know, she's not playing Call of Duty and Mortal Kombat. But it is shocking. If you haven't picked up a game lately or seen it, the level of realism, it's stunning. Yes. And, you know, again, plenty of people play it, and it's an outlet for them in some way, shape, or form. Let me ask you that, because it's something I've been curious for a very long time about. Look, the school shooting numbers and all that stuff has skyrocketed. And I can see a direct correlation to a little game called Grand Theft Auto 3 that was released in about 2001-ish. And it was after that, after we simulated living real life and going on killing sprees, that we saw people going in real life and going on killing sprees at mass numbers. I'm not specifically blaming Grand Theft Auto. If it wasn't them, something else would have done it. Has this, in some ways, the evolution of these games, has it been more of a cathartic thing, giving people who otherwise would go out and shoot a place up a place to do it safely, civilly, in their own home, on their own screen? Or has this necessarily increased the idea and increased the likelihood that someone's going to go act this out over the last 25 years of evolution of these things?
We have some research on people who have committed mass murders and video game play. Mm-hmm. And it seems that they play in a qualitatively different way. They do immerse themselves in their character to the point they're identifying with whatever character that they're portraying in the game, you know, their avatar. And they really view it as rehearsal. And so I think a lot of people can stay clear on this is just a fantasy. You know, they don't take it seriously. They're not fantasizing about murdering people mm-hmm. in real life. But some of these guys, and again, they tend to be autistic. They tend to have a lot of social problems. They tend to be angry. The games reinforce mm-hmm. that sense of power comes through the weapon and power comes through killing. And they get very desensitized to horrific violence. So I've been really concerned for a long time about the graphic violence in video games. And yeah, they're murder simulators. That's my term.
Yeah, I mean, as if we look statistically at life, since these things have gotten to the level that they've gotten at, I would say feels like things have gotten a bit worse in this department, if not a lot more worse. Siobhan Scott, The Mind of Mass Killers, available wherever books are sold. Just Google it, Amazon it, whatever you may do, Goodreads, whatever it is. Ask your local bookstore, you know, to put a bird on it when you order it, too. Just add a little bird. It's a Portlandia reference for Siobhan, who's in Portland. Anyway, Siobhan, as always, thank you so much for your insight on this case and all of our cases that we cover here at Hidden Killers and True Crime Today.
Thank you.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.